composed of hundreds and even of thousands of individuals. The category capitalist has itself become a social category. It has become socialized within the framework of capitalist society. In that case, how shall we explain Bernstein's belief that the phenomenon of shareholding societies stands for the dispersion and not the concentration of capital? Why does he see the extension of capitalist property where Marx saw its suppression? That is a simple economic error. By capitalist, Bernstein does not mean a category of production but the right to property. To him, capitalist is not an economic unit but a fiscal unit, and capital is for him not a factor of production but simply a certain quantity of money. That is why in his English Sewing Thread Trust he does not see the fusion of 12,300 persons with money into a single capitalist unit, but 12,300 different capitalists. That is why the engineer Schultz, whose wife's dowry bought him a large number of shares from stockholder Mueller, is also a capitalist for Bernstein. That is why for Bernstein the entire world seems to swarm with capitalists. Here too, the theoretic base of his economic error is his popularization of socialism. For this is what he does. By transporting the concept of capitalism from its productive relations to property relations, and by speaking of simple individuals instead of speaking of entrepreneurs, he moves the question of socialism from the domain of production into the domain of relations of fortune, that is, from the relation between capital and labour to the relation between poor and rich. In this manner, we are merrily led from Marx and Engels to the author of The Evangel of the Poor Fisherman. There is this difference, however. Veitlin, with the sure instinct of the proletarian, saw in the opposition between the poor and the rich the class antagonisms in their primitive form, and wanted to make of these antagonisms a lever of the movement for socialism. Bernstein, on the other hand, locates the realization of socialism in the possibility of making the poor rich. That is, he locates it in the attenuation of class antagonisms and therefore in the petty bourgeoisie. True, Bernstein does not limit himself to the statistics of incomes. He furnishes statistics of economic enterprises, especially those of the following countries: Germany, France, England, Switzerland, Austria, and the United States. But these statistics are not the comparative figures of different periods in each country, but of each period in different countries. We are not therefore offered, with the exception of Germany, where he repeats the old contrast between 1895 and 1892, a comparison of the statistics of enterprises of a given country at different epochs, but the absolute figures for different countries: England in 1891, France in 1894, United States in 1890, etc. He reaches the following conclusion. Though it is true that large exploitation is already supreme in industry today, it nevertheless represents, including the enterprises dependent on large exploitation, even in a country as developed in Prussia, only half of the population occupied in production. This is also true about Germany, England, Belgium, etc. What does he actually prove here? He proves not the existence of such or such a tendency of economic development, but merely the absolute relation of forces of different forms of enterprise, or put in other words, the absolute relations of the various classes in our society. Now, if one wants to prove in this manner the impossibility of realizing socialism, one's reasoning must rest on the theory according to which the result of social efforts is decided by the relation of the numerical material forces of the elements in the struggle. That is, by the factor of violence. In other words, Bernstein, who always thunders against Blanquism, himself falls into the grossest Blanquist error. There is this difference, however. To the Blanquists, who represented a socialist and revolutionary tendency, the possibility of the economic realization of socialism appeared quite natural. On this possibility, they built the chances of a violent revolution, even by a small minority. Bernstein, on the contrary, infers from the numerical insufficiency of a socialist majority the impossibility of the economic realization of socialism. The social democracy does not, however, expect to attain its aim either as a result of the victorious violence of a minority or through the numerical superiority of a majority. It sees socialism come as a result of economic necessity and the comprehension of that necessity leading to the suppression of capitalism by the working masses. And this necessity manifests itself above all in the anarchy of capitalism. What is Bernstein's position on the decisive question of anarchy in capitalist economy? He denies only the great general crises. He does not deny partial and national crises. In other words, he refuses to see a great deal of the anarchy of capitalism. He sees only a little of it. He is, to use Marx's illustration, like the foolish virgin who had a child who was only very small. But the misfortune is that in matters like economic anarchy, little and much are equally bad. If Bernstein recognises the existence of a little of this anarchy, we may point out to him that by the mechanism of the market economy, this bit of anarchy will be extended to unheard-of proportions to end in collapse. But if Bernstein hopes to transform gradually his bit of anarchy into order and harmony while maintaining the system of commodity production, he again falls into one of the fundamental errors of bourgeois political economy, according to which the mode of exchange is independent of the mode of production. This is not the place for a lengthy demonstration of Bernstein's surprising confusion concerning the most elementary principles of political economy. But there is one point to which we are led by the fundamental questions of capitalist anarchy that must be clarified immediately. Bernstein declares that Marx's law of surplus value is a simple abstraction. In political economy, a statement of this sort obviously constitutes an insult. But if surplus value is only a simple abstraction, if it is only a figment of the mind, then every normal citizen who has done military duty and pays his taxes on time has the same right as Karl Marx to fashion his individual absurdity, to make his own law of value. Marx has as much right to neglect the qualities of commodities till they are no more than the incarnation of qualities of simple human labour, as have the economists of the Boehm-Jevon school to make an abstraction of all the qualities of commodities outside of their utility. That is, to Bernstein, Marx's social labour and Menger's abstract utility are quite similar, pure abstractions. Bernstein forgets completely that Marx's abstraction is not an invention. It is a discovery. It does not exist in Marx's head, but in market economy. It has not an imaginary existence, but a real social existence, so real that it can be cut, hammered, weighed, and put in the form of the money. The abstract human labour discovered by Marx is, in its developed form, no other than money. That is precisely one of the greatest of Marx's discoveries, while to all bourgeois political economists, from the first of the mercantilists to the last of the classicists, the essence of money has remained a mystic enigma. The Boehm-Jevon's abstract utility is in fact a conceit of the mind, or stated more correctly, it is a representation of intellectual emptiness, a private absurdity, for which neither capitalism nor any other society can be made responsible, but only vulgar bourgeois economy itself. Hugging their brainchild, Bernstein, Boehm and Jevons, and the entire subjective fraternity, can remain 20 years or more before the mystery of money, without arriving at a solution that is different from the one reached by any cobbler, namely that money is also a useful thing. Bernstein has lost all comprehension of Marx's law of value. Anybody with a small understanding of Marxian economics can see that without the law of value, Marx's doctrine is incomprehensible. Or, to speak more concretely, for him who does not understand the nature of the commodity and its exchange, the entire economy of capitalism, with all its concatenations, must of necessity remain an enigma. What precisely was the key which enabled Marx to open the door to the secrets of capitalist phenomena and solve, as if in play, problems that were not even suspected by the greatest minds of classic bourgeois economy? It was his conception of capitalist economy as a historic phenomenon, not merely in the sense recognised in the best of cases by the classic economists, that is, when it concerns the feudal past of capitalism, but also insofar as it concerns the socialist future of the world. The secret of Marx's theory of value, of his analysis of the problem of money, of his theory of capital, of the theory of the rate of profit and consequently of the entire existing economic system, is found in the transitory character of capitalist economy, the inevitability of its collapse leading, and this is only another aspect of the same phenomenon, to socialism. It is only because Marx looked at capitalism from the socialist's viewpoint, that is, from the historic viewpoint, that he was enabled to decipher the hieroglyphics of capitalist economy. And it is precisely because he took the socialist viewpoint as a point of departure for his analysis of bourgeois society that he was in the position to give a scientific base to the socialist movement. This is the measure by which we evaluate Bernstein's remarks. He complains of the dualism found everywhere in Marx's monumental Capital. Quote, "The work wishes to be a scientific study and prove at the same time a thesis that was completely elaborated a long time before the editing of the book. It is based on a schema that already contains the result to which he wants to lead. The return to the Communist Manifesto, that is, the socialist goal, proves the existence of vestiges of utopianism in Marx's doctrine." End quote. But what is Marx's dualism, if not the dualism of the socialist future and the capitalist present? It is the dualism of capitalism and labour, the dualism of the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. It is the scientific reflection of the dualism existing in bourgeois society, the dualism of the class antagonism writhing inside the social order of capitalism. Bernstein's recognition of this theoretic dualism in Marx as a survival of utopianism is really his naive avowal that he denies the class antagonisms in capitalism. It is his confession that socialism has become for him only a survival of utopianism. What is Bernstein's monism? Bernstein's unity, but the eternal unity of the capitalist regime. The unity of the former socialist who has renounced his aim and has decided to find in bourgeois society, one and immutable, the goal of human development. Bernstein does not see in the economic structure of capitalism the development that leads to socialism, but in order to conserve his socialist program, at least in form, he is obliged to take refuge in an idealist construction placed outside of all economic development. He is obliged to transform socialism itself from a definite historical phase of social development into an abstract principle. That is why the cooperative principle, the meagre decantation of socialism by which Bernstein wishes to garnish capitalist economy, appears as a concession made not to the socialist future of society, but to Bernstein's own socialist past. Chapter 7. Cooperatives, Unions, Democracy. Bernstein's socialism offers to the workers the prospect of sharing in the wealth of society. The poor are to become rich. How will this socialism be brought about? His article in the Neue Zeit contains only vague allusions to this question. Adequate information, however, can be found in his book. Bernstein's socialism is to be realised with the aid of these two instruments, labour unions, or as Bernstein himself characterises them, economic democracy, and cooperatives. The first will suppress industrial profit, the second will do away with commercial profit. Cooperatives, especially cooperatives in the field of production, constitute a hybrid form in the midst of capitalism. They can be described as small units of socialised production within capitalist production. But in capitalist economy, exchanges dominate production. As a result of competition, the complete domination of the process of production by the interests of capital, that is, pitiless exploitation, becomes a condition for the survival of each enterprise. The domination of capital over the process of production expresses itself in the following ways. Labour is intensified. The workday is lengthened or shortened according to the situation of the market. And, depending on the requirements of the market, labour is either employed or thrown back into the street. In other words, use is made of all methods that enable an enterprise to stand up against its competitors in the market. The workers forming a cooperative in the field of production are thus faced with the contradictory necessity of governing themselves with the utmost absolutism. They are obliged to take toward themselves the role of capitalist entrepreneur, a contradiction that accounts for the usual failure of production cooperatives, which either become pure capitalist enterprises or, if the workers' interests continue to predominate, end by dissolving. Bernstein himself has taken note of these facts, but it is evident that he has not understood them, for together with Mrs. Potter Webb, he explains the failure of production cooperatives in England by their lack of discipline. But what is so superficially and flatly called here discipline is nothing else than the natural absolutist regime of capitalism, which, it is plain, the workers cannot successfully use against themselves. Producers' cooperatives can survive within capitalist economy only if they manage to suppress, by means of some detour, the capitalist-controlled contradictions between the mode of production and the mode of exchange. And they can accomplish this only by removing themselves artificially from the influence of the laws of free competition. And they can succeed in doing the last only when they assure themselves beforehand of a constant circle of consumers, that is, when they assure themselves of a constant market. It is the consumer's cooperative that can offer this service to its brother in the field of production. Here, and not in Oppenheimer's distinction between cooperatives that produce and cooperatives that sell, is the secret sought by Bernstein, the explanation for the invariable failure of producers' cooperatives functioning independently and their survival when they are backed by consumers' organisations. If it is true that the possibilities of existence of producers' cooperatives within capitalism are bound up with the possibilities of existence of consumers' cooperatives, then the scope of the former is limited, in the most favourable of cases, to the small local market and to the manufacture of articles serving immediate needs, especially food products. Consumers and therefore producers' cooperatives are excluded from the most important branches of capital production, the textile, mining, metallurgical and petroleum industries, machine construction, locomotive and shipbuilding. For this reason alone, forgetting for the moment their hybrid character, cooperatives in the field of production cannot be seriously considered as the instrument of a general social transformation. The establishment of producers' cooperatives on a wide scale would suppose, first of all, the suppression of the world market, the breaking up of the present world economy into small local spheres of production and exchange. The highly developed widespread of capitalism in our time is expected to fall back to the merchant economy of the Middle Ages. Within the framework of present society, producers' cooperatives are limited to the role of simple annexes to consumers' cooperatives. It appears, therefore, that the latter must be the beginning of the proposed social change. But this way, the expected reform of society by means of cooperatives ceases to be an offensive against capitalist production. That is, it ceases to be an attack against the principal basis of capitalist economy. It becomes instead a struggle against commercial capital, especially small and middle-sized commercial capital. It becomes an attack made on the twigs of the capitalist tree. According to Bernstein, trade unions too are a means of attack against capitalism in the field of production. We have already shown that trade unions cannot give the workers a determining influence over production. Trade unions can determine